tonight on Arena. Stuart Copeland rearranges the songs of The Police in Police Deranged for Orchestra, and John Carter Cash on the songs of his dad, Johnny. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rt.ie/arena. Galway International Arts Festival begins in 3 weeks' time on July 15th, and Arena will be there on the first week for two shows. One of the major stars of this year's festival is legendary drummer with The Police, Stuart Copeland. Following a successful period of creating film music and opera, last year Stuart returned to his roots and released his diaries from the early days of The Police, the band he formed with Sting, later to be joined by Andy Summers. He also recorded an album of Police songs called Police Deranged for Orchestra. There he deconstructed and rearranged some of their most memorable songs for the orchestra. He's now taking the album on tour, and on July 17th, Deranged will be performed in the Heineken Big Top in Galway at the International Arts Festival, with Eimear Noon conducting and Stuart himself on the drums. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Stuart Copeland. Stuart, welcome back to Arena.
Well, it's good to be here with you.
And now, you spoke to Sean Rocks last year when the album came out, but now you have it on the road. Tell me what audience can expect in Galway. You on the drums, obviously, Galway's own Eimear Noon on the baton, but what else have we?
Well, these songs everybody knows, which is the good part. There is a real power in a song that is known, much more emotional impact in Roxanne or Every Breath You Take than in a new song. So what you can expect is songs that you know, but they have been slightly lobotomized or deranged.
I don't know if you can be slightly lobotomized, but fair enough.
Yeah, just a little incision there. No, the reason that they were deranged was for a film that I made, comprised of my Super 8 footage that turned into a movie and required a score. So I got Police music, carved it all up. And once the scalpel was out, the orgy began, taking Andy's guitar solo from here and putting it with that bass line from over there, and generally disassembling and reassembling in bizarre forms this familiar music. Now, you will recognize it. You will be able to sing along, but they're in ways that you've never heard before. That's the derangements part. But the orchestra part, which is where Eimear comes in, with Eimear on the podium there, the orchestra is actually the orchestra that recorded the album in Dublin. I spent a few glorious days in Dublin recording this orchestra, and they will be on stage in the big tent in Galway. And so it's an orchestral experience of songs that you know well, me banging stuff.
Now there's
there will be the three singers on stage too, three soul singers on the mic.
Yes, tell us about those three singers. They've wonderful voices and they sing so harmoniously.
Yes, in fact, it was during the arrangement of the voices that I discovered something rather surprising. You know, I never listened to the words of our songs. I mean, I'm just at the back of the stage banging stuff, and all I ever see is the back of his head. You know, if he turns around, he's probably yelling at me. So I'm happy to see the best. So I never really, I never listen to lyrics. I listen to the riff. But doing these arrangements, I was forced to acknowledge and discover that old Stingo, and don't tell him I said this, kind of a genius. You know, those lyrics are really something. All these years, gosh, I never knew. But they really are beautiful lyrics. And then, of course, the melodies and the riffs that I remember are also very powerful too. But arranging these songs for the singers really woke me up to the depth of his lyrics.
Yes, because when you met Sting all those years ago back in the 70s in Newcastle and then connected up again in London, he was not the singer-songwriter. Well, he was the singer, but not the songwriter at that stage. And you were a drummer who was just about to leave your band.
Yes. Well, under the hood, none of us realized what he had in store for himself and us. Not even he suspected that he was just such a writer of memorable songs. But he, I think, you know, he was playing jazz when we met. But listening to the punk music with this distilled form, verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus, you know, very, very constrained form of songs, that discipline combined with Andy Summers joining the band with his harmonic sophistication, and suddenly the light bulb went off in Stingo's head and he started writing those big songs. When we stuck together for a year and a half playing my crap songs, which were just songs of utility to get us into the punk clubs, you know, bass lines with yelling, basically. But then it suddenly came together, and we, after starving for almost 2 years, he started writing those big songs, you know, Roxanne, Can't Stand Losing You, then Message in a Bottle, and so on, and his biggest song of all, Every Breath You Take.
And can you remember that day? Was Roxanne the first song he brought to you? What did you think?
No, he had other songs, but they were kind of in the same ilk as the stuff that I was writing. It was, you know, Born in the 50s was good, and a few others, Visions in the Night and so on. But he hadn't really hit pay dirt yet. And Roxanne was the one where the band's sound kind of crystallized.
That distinct reggae rhythm that some of the songs like Roxanne and Can't Stand Losing You have, did that come from you? Because you had this very exotic youth. You were brought up in the Middle East, in the Lebanon. So you were open to world music, for example.
Well, what has been called reggae was actually more accurately could be described as Arabic rhythm, which shares a couple of fundamental rhythmic features of reggae. Excuse me, including the emphasis on the third beat of the bar. You know, rock music is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, da da do da. They call it the backbeat. Da do da da do da da. Well, reggae lands on the third, and Arabic music also lands on the third beat of the bar. Da boom, da da 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, and the absence of 1, 2, 3, 4, void, 2, 3, 4, and so this music, those rhythms were in my DNA and was kind of my secret sauce when it came to the confluence of punk and reggae.
Well, let's listen to Old Stingo and some of your hot sauce in This Is Roxanne.
You don't care if it's wrong or if it's right, Roxanne. You don't have to put on the red light, Roxanne.
The original Roxanne there from The Police, and I'm talking to Stuart Copeland, who is bringing his Police Deranged for Orchestra to the Galway International Arts Festival in July. Before those famous tensions, Stuart, bubbled up between the band members, what was it like collaborating with Andy and with Sting?
Well, at first we were codependent and couldn't get enough of each other, even with out great songs to play yet. We hadn't happened on those great songs yet. We still had a musical bond. I just knew that bass player lights me up and we're right for each other, even without any songs to play. And then when Andy joined, we couldn't believe our luck because he was way above us in the hierarchy. He was a very sought after and expensive session guitarist. And, you know, we were a starveling fake punk band going nowhere. And for, you know, by some great blessing, Andy discovered us, as he said to me, Stuart, you and that bass player, you got something, but you need me in the band, and I accept.
Well, that
was our Andy.
well, that was good fortune for you and for Andy.
Yeah, well, because that was the ingredient that made everything. That made the pastry rise right there.
The Police rapidly rose to fame, selling 75 million records, filling stadia around the world and receiving 6 Grammy Awards. Can you remember that as a heady time, as a really satisfying creative time for you there behind the drums?
Well, yes. It was, in hindsight, very creative. And we were all three very proud of what we made together. But at that time, it was hell on earth. The Police was like a Prada suit made out of razor blades. Very cool, but not comfortable. It was not a cozy band. We now, after, you know, on the reunion tour, we went through band therapy and we figured out the cause of our differences. And they're all very respectable reasons for this. No ego, no satanic evil lurking. It was for very honest reasons. We rubbed each other up the wrong way. You know, we make music for different reasons. We listen to different kinds of music. We make music by different means and for a different purpose. And when we were young and codependent, that was all good, and it was inspiring. Then as we went through, you know, five albums, those conflicts became more and more difficult. And now old Stingo, who at first was loved it, we like his song. Oh, wow, cool. You want to completely mess up the rhythm? Sure, fine. Later on, having written a hit or two or three or four or five or six, he started to get the strange notion that he's pretty good at writing hit songs. And so it became more and more difficult for him to compromise. I mean, because he didn't just think of a song. He thought of the whole arrangement and everything, which he would bring in and then have to put up with the other two guys in the band who also had creative ideas. And he was actually very loyal. That's one of his main characteristics. He's a very loyal guy. He still has the same crew around him today that he's had for half a century. So he stuck it out and put up with us and put up with those compromises until he couldn't stand it anymore.
And that was.
And by the way, at that time too, I had an out. The police was so uncomfortable that when I went and did a film score, which is where I learned how to do all this orchestra stuff, it was just a world outside of that. Those three guys that was just beautiful, musical, working with Francis Coppola, and just, oh man, life outside this band can be glorious. And so that's why we parted ways.
Yes, and that working on film scores and going into orchestration and even beyond that into opera, that did go back to your family roots, where both your father and your mother, more particularly, were interested in people like Aaron Copland and classical music.
That's right. My father was more into jazz, wrong jazz, as has been described by my jazz friends. Like, that's to say, white big band jazz. And so that didn't really stick. But my mother was listening to Debussy and Karl Orff and Stravinsky. And so that did stick. And then even when Jimi Hendrix came along when I was 16, that just turned everything upside down. The Stravinsky stuck, and that 20th century classical music stuck. And it's always been there. I've always had, you know, Jimi Hendrix guitar solos and Rites of Spring going through my head at the same time, which is why I'm a little crazy. And so when I got an involuntary education in how to use the orchestra in my 20 years before the mast as a hired gun film composer, that's when I was able to bring the orchestra into my rock and roll world.
So we're going to listen to the deranged version of Every Breath You Take. Will you talk us into that, Stuart, about how you approached it with orchestration in mind?
Well, the way I approached this particular song is to hand it over to Emer Noon and her husband.
Good idea.
Craig, yes, and her husband, Stuart Gray Garfinkel. Of all the songs, this is the only one that I did not arrange myself. And the reason for that is that, you know, I did all my favorite songs and then used up all my juices, if you like. And then, you know, there's that, the biggest hit. I'll get stoned. I'll get pitchforked if I don't play Every Breath You Take, by which time I thought, screw it. And I handed it off to Emer, and wow, what a result.
All right, you know, so you were a bit nervous of that one.
No, it was just that I'd sort of said what I had to say with the orchestration, and I wanted to see what Emer could do. And it's quite humbling because she actually does know what she's doing. I kind of learned on the job, but she had the training, the experience, and between the two of them, they came up with this amazing version of Every Breath You Take.
Every Breath You Take there, originally from the Police, of course, and now Deranged and Rearranged by Stuart Copeland. Stuart, when you see this back catalogue of wonderful work that you were so involved in, how do you approach the orchestration?
Well, I've learned a thing or two about what sounds cool. You know, as I say, 20 years, you know, I was an employee. You know, the film composer's not even an artist. He's an employee serving the art of, let's call him a craftsman, serving the art of the director. And you learn more, I discovered, as an employee than you do as an artist. Mm-hmm. And so I learned the chops, the skill set, that, you know, how, you know, what the trombones are good at and how to put it on the page for them and what the different sections in the orchestra are good at and how to put it on the page for it. And that, how to put it on the page, is the big part, the language of orchestration. And so that each of those players, who, by the way, they don't see the other parts. The flute player doesn't have any idea what the basses are playing because he's only looking at his book, which only contains his flute part. So getting it on the page correctly took me 20 years of working with orchestra, and not just getting it on the page correctly, but all of the cool stuff, the huge wide vocabulary of the orchestra. I mean, the orchestra can do more stuff than a guitar can. You know, Andy Summers was pretty amazing with the orchestral textures that he could create, but an orchestra just has such a wide vocabulary of, you know, it can rage high, it can surge, you know, up onto the mountains, it can dig deep into the bowels of emotion, it can softly serenade and break your heart. It just has so much that an orchestra can do, and this is what I learned under the harsh yoke of cruel employ.
And then when you came to do those songs, you do the individual parts and then there's the mixing, and obviously the vocals are imposed on the mixing.
Yeah, well, that's for making a record. Now, there's a big difference between making a record. And by the way, this orchestra that you'll be seeing in the big tent is the orchestra that recorded the album. I spent a few glorious days in Dublin mm-hmm. recording these incredible players. So this is actually the same orchestra that's on the record. Making music to come out of speakers is easy. You just keep banging away until it sounds nice. But making music for other people to play at a later date, i.e. creating a score, a piece of paper for others to read and perform with, that is a very different animal and requires much, much more concentration and thinking. You know, because the tune isn't da-da-da-da-da-da-da, it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you have to put what I call the Italian on the page, the accents, the articulation, the shape. And you have to, the more information you can put on the page, the more accurately and beautifully the orcs will play.
And what will your role playing the drums be in relation to the orchestra? Are you leading the orchestra or are you there as the percussion section?
Well, Emer, of course, was boss of everything,
of course.
But I will be banging stuff, and I am an untamed beast. The guy who composes and who orchestrates is an urbane, kindly gentleman, safe with children. The guy banging drums, different animal, an instinctive being, just banging stuff, and basically Emer keeps the orchestra on the page, while this monstrosity is banging stuff on the drums. That's
so she
me.
Leaves you free.
Oh, absolutely. Well, she keeps it sane.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic evening. My thanks to Stuart Copeland. And Stuart will be performing music from his album Police Deranged for Orchestra with a 28-piece orchestra conducted by Emer Noon at the Heineken Big Top at Galway International Arts Festival on July 17. Full details on giaf.ie. And we'll leave you now with another track from Stuart's Police Deranged for Orchestra album, Can't Stand Losing You, Deranged. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Ah, well, thank you for listening. Can't wait to be over there.
You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. The Man Comes Around is a much-played song from the final album of Johnny Cash, recorded before his death in 2003. Now the Man in Black himself has come around again, as the voice and soul of the album he initially cut in 1993, titled Songwriter. It will be released on Friday the 28th of June. Author, producer and musician John Carter Cash co-produced the album of work solely written by his late father, Johnny Cash. It's called Songwriter, and John Carter Cash joins me now. You're very welcome, John.
Hello. It's wonderful to talk to you. I miss Ireland. Great to hear your voice.
Well, it's great to hear you. Now, as well as being the son of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, you're also an esteemed, award-winning music producer. Did you know these song demos of songs that your father had self-penned existed?
Yes, I did. I was actually on some of the original recordings. I heard my guitar on the multi-tracks. But, you know, it's something that at the time my father was looking forward to making the American series, and his head really was in a different place. So when this was recorded, he wasn't necessarily thinking of it as a release. But now, looking back all these years, we have an amazing voice. His voice is so powerful on these recordings. And just the fact that it stands out as being original songs, things that he wrote himself, it makes it a very rare record. And, you know, it took us a while to decide to go ahead and to put something together as a release. There is material that could be released. You know, I don't want to just release something to put it out. It's got to be something that makes sense and got to be something that I feel like is important for his legacy. He was at a great spot in his life when he recorded this music, and you certainly can hear it in his voice.
And these songs, you then arranged a group of people who you have worked with in the past and who your dad had worked with in the past when you arranged this music. So what did you do first? Did you get rid of everything except for Johnny Cash's voice and the guitar?
Well, pretty much. It was the strongest thing that was there. It was also the strong, consistent line through everything. It was my father's voice and his guitar where we could use it. And then added a guitar backing him to sort of put the tracks together in a way that made sense. At that point, we did add drums and bass and you know, a few other things. But I tried to keep working with David Ferguson, my co-producer. We tried to keep everything a simple production and create background music that would be fitting for, you know, just the appropriate backdrop behind the Man in Black who ran everything.
Now, let's listen to one of the tracks. We'll start with Well, All Right. Could you talk us into this? This is a very humorous song.
Yeah, it's just a fun song. Dad put himself in the place of a guy who meets a lovely lady in a laundromat and falls in love. It's full of wit and humor, double entendre. You know, it's an everyman's tale, but it's a lot of fun, and you can hear my father's character all throughout it.
I met her at the laundromat, she was washing extra hot. I said, don't you need a little help with that big load you got? She said no, but did a double take, and then she smiled and said, I might. As I rolled up my sleeves, I said to myself, well, all right, well, all right. I put it on automatic, and she sat down on the floor. She said, just keep it on medium hot. I said, I've done this before. Then I opened up the dryer and I set it on soft and light. She said, be gentle with my silk and lace. And I said, well, all right. Well, all right. Her clothes were in the basket, folded down so nice and warm. She headed for the door and I said, I will take you home. She said, I just live up the street. I said, it's a dangerous night. Take my arm and I'll carry the basket. And she said, well, all right, well, all right. The world's half full of women and the world's half full of men. And sometimes one or the other opens up to let one in. But the one I met at the laundromat that dangerous, beautiful night said, yes, I do, and yes, I will. And I said, well, all right. Well, all right.
I'll never think of the laundry the same way again. What a wonderful song.
I'm telling you. Yeah, definitely. Keep it down soft and light.
And extra, she's extra hot. I mean, it's so good.
Keep it on extra hot, definitely. But it's a lot of fun, you know. Dad had a way of telling a story.
Yes, and John, have you memories of him writing songs, and when would he write them?
He would go on the road and travel and perform, and he wouldn't write much when he was traveling. But when he got home from a tour, he sometimes would go to his farm or he would go to his cabin in the woods, and he would write then. He would write usually when he was alone. He hardly ever wrote with other people. It was fun for him. It was some sort of almost therapy for him at times. It's his way of expressing himself, but it was just him enjoying life and letting the music come out from having lived life.
Those songs, I mean, his voice is so crystal clear in that. I mean, the recordings, as you say, he was in a very good place. His voice is sounding as good as when it was at its peak.
Yes, definitely so. Yeah, it was a peak for him. And this is right before, a real renaissance in his life when he was about to record some records that were going to win Grammys and get high acclaim. And he was stepping into a new part of his career. And this is right at the cusp of that. It's very interesting. In February of 1993, he performed on stage in Dublin. And U2 got up and sang with Dad. Everybody in the band but Edge. Got up and were on stage with Dad. I was there myself when I was playing in the group with him in 1993, and that's something I'll never forget. The next day after that, Bono wrote the song "The Wanderer," and Dad put down his vocal for the track. And later on that month, he met Rick Rubin, and then not long after that, he recorded all this music.
And you also had the joy, I'm sure, as being an associate producer on your father's albums.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I worked with Dad in the studio almost every session from American 3 until the last two albums that came out after he passed away, the posthumous releases that were part of the American series.
And, I mean, you learned to music at your father and mother's and grandparents' knees. So that idea of working together on musical projects wasn't strange for you, was it? Or was it a bit daunting being in the studio with him?
No, not really at all. I mean, it's a course in life, you know. But, I mean, my father was always, it was all about family to him. And it had to be something that he felt comfortable with. But he loved so many people that he worked with in the studio. But I'm so grateful I had the chance to work with him as a producer, as a co-producer, as an associate producer, or just to spend the time with him. And it's sort of, the early part of my career when I was developing my talents.
And when you were developing your own talents and working on the road with your father and your mother, did you find it hard to break out and forge your own career, being in the shadow of such wonderful musicians?
You know, they were good people, really sort of straight from the heart. And they never got puffed up in their heads. They always stayed true to where they came from. And that's something that made it that much easier, I had to develop. My dad always said to my mother also, follow your love, whatever it is your bliss is, whatever your joy is in life, follow that. And that's really, when you're doing that, it's free, it's good, it's an easier path than some competition or trying to be something that I'm not. And I've had that opportunity. And I mean, I've worked more in the studio. I worked more with Loretta Lynn than I ever had a chance to work with my mother or father. So I've spent a lot of time in the studio with artists from various walks of music, and it's been a great blessing. But they were always supportive. My parents were.
Tell us about working with the great Loretta Lynn.
She was wonderful. She was like my mother in so many ways, just her spirit, her energy in the studio, her humor, her attitude. You know, I co-produced a lot of music for her with her daughter, Patsy Russell, and just adored Loretta. I just, one of the bright points in my life was having the chance to work with her as much as I did.
You had a very, even though you were on the road and you had all the glamour of being on the road with Johnny Cash and with June Carter Cash, you also had, they both were people who love nature and the cabin you spoke about. You spent a lot of time in the woods hunting and doing quite normal things with your folks.
Yes, I spent a lot of time, you know, in the outdoors fishing with my father, you know, and traveling was an adventure to them. We were all over Ireland when I was young, you know, in a small tour bus. I remember being there. And of course, my father penned a beautiful song about Ireland, 40 Shades of Green. And he would sing that for the folks on stage there from when I could remember. And every person in the whole audience knew every word. And so we felt very accepted there. But my parents, they were loving people and they always had a great time, and they were my best friends really growing up.
And talking about 40 Shades of Green, I know it's that your father wrote it, but so many people would argue almost with him that he didn't write it because it was seemed so authentically Irish.
Yeah, he had some fella tell him one time that his mother sang it to him when he was a boy, and Dad said, "Well, what year would that have been?" And the fellow said, 1963. And my dad said, "Well, I wrote it in 1958. So, he would, you know, because it's so cherished by the Irish people, gratefully.
So, John, talk us into another song. We have Spotlight here. Tell me a little bit about the song that your dad wrote and then what you did as a producer.
Well, basically from the original track, my dad's guitar is there a little bit, and then it's his voice. But there's a wonderful driving bass rhythm that sort of makes the song. Great drums and tone on the electric guitars. Dan Arbach from the Black Keys came in as a guest on this song. He plays the lead guitar. It's one of my favorite tracks on the record just because it has such a spirit to it. It's got a real, like an earthy rhythm, and something that to me is just quintessential Johnny Cash.
Spotlight, don't let it show that my heart went with her when I let her go. Don't let anybody see deep within the soul of me, or they'll see that something there is not quite right. Tonight, spotlight, spotlight, that's way too much. Let there be upon the air a tender touch. Let your magic velvet hue bathe me in a gentle blue, softly so there's not a single tear inside. Tonight, spotlight.
That spotlight from Johnny Cash's album called Songwriter, which is produced, brought to us by his son, John Carter Cash. And John Carter Cash is with me now. John, to move on to other people who you have produced. You've produced Elvis Costello, Kris Kristofferson, Emmylou Harris, Vince Gill. What for you is the key to production? Given your examples, those fine examples there, we've been listening to what you did with those recordings of your dad. Is it less is more? Let the vocal shine.
I think that's very important. It's to let the artists be themselves and to capture. I like to capture what happens, the energy and the excitement of making new music. I'm not one for rules in the studio. To me, somebody can be open-minded. It's a place to take chances. It's a place to see what works and what doesn't work. It's number one. It's got to be fun. That's the rule. It has to be fun. It has to be something you're enjoying. And once you're doing that, it's all free. It's all good. And those are the best recordings I've ever been a part of, are the ones, you know, where it's just a great energy and there's a laughter behind it.
And was this one fun, or was it just very poignant working with you?
It was fun. It was great to get into the studio, you know, with the folks that were part of the record. It was wonderful to work with David Ferguson, who I've known and worked with off and on since I was 15 years old. It was great to get back in contact with my dad again and to feel like I was in the studio with him again and to hear his voice at a time when he had such strength and you know, behind the melody.
Well, John Carter Cash, thank you so much for talking to us.
Certainly. I'm glad to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. And Johnny Cash's new posthumous album, Songwriter, is out on Friday the 28th of June on digital CD and vinyl. When Brian Friel died in 2015, his reputation as one of Ireland's greatest playwrights was assured at home and abroad. Friel's plays, Philadelphia, Here I Come, Translations, Dancing at Lunasa and Faith Healer are central to the Irish theatrical canon. Author and academic Kelly Matthews was researching in a BBC archive when she came across 100 letters written by Friel in the 1960s. These letters shed new light on the young writer who bravely gave up his day job as a teacher to write full time. But what greeted him initially were some minor triumphs, but no shortage of rejection letters. Her new biography, Brian Friel Beginnings, takes us back to that uncertain time. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Kelly Matthews, who is in Dublin for a few days. She's the Professor of English at Farmington State University in Massachusetts. You're very welcome, Kelly. When you were researching Northern Irish writers who wrote for radio, then you came upon these letters. What were you expecting? Were you even looking for Friel, or did you just come across a file with Friel's name on it?
In fact, I was not specifically looking for Friel. I had travelled to the BBC written archives outside of Reading and had requested a long list of plays by, well, files from every Irish writer who wrote for BBC Radio during the 1950s and 60s. And so, in fact, I only stumbled on the Brian Friel file on my third day in the archives. I spent the two previous days looking at Joseph Tomalty and Janet McNeil, two radio playwrights from Belfast. And although I knew that Friel had had some plays produced on the radio, I was astounded, actually, at the depth of mentorship and comradeship that he developed with the Belfast radio producer Ronald Mason. And that's what I found in his file, which, as you say, was quite thick with over 100 letters between the two men. And it began in 1957, so almost a decade before the success of Philadelphia, Here I Come. And that's what so excited me, was to see the beginning date on this correspondence.
Yes, because we don't, I mean, Brian Friel did do some interviews, but as he became more famous, he did very few interviews. I mean, of course, the work stood for itself, but you didn't get an insight into what kind of man he was. But this young man surprised you.
Oh, by far, yes, absolutely. He was very warm and funny, and I think that is true, you know, throughout his career, as those who knew him well will attest. But you're right that he shunned, might be too strong a word, but he withdrew from interviews and from kind of the spotlight and put his work forward rather than himself once he became successful. As a young man, however, he was quite hungry for feedback. He was quite accepting of feedback. He made extensive revisions to his early plays and short stories, and he was very skilled at developing strong relationships and very respectful and deep relationships with his first radio producer and then his short story editor as well.
And now they weren't all thinking he was the great playwright he was going to become and they were going to nurture him. He got a lot of rejections and a lot of negative feedback.
Absolutely. And that was also surprising to me. I didn't know how many, short stories he had rejected at The New Yorker, for example, around 40 short stories were rejected. Nor did I know, how much development he had to do on his first plays. Some of them were cut by a third. The lines in the script were just kind of energetically crossed out by his radio producer, and he very quickly made changes and worked at a very energetic pace.
So when you found this treasure trove, if that wasn't enough, you got greedy then. You got a hunch that if he had correspondence, because he sounded like somebody who in his letters would get responses, you went off to The New Yorker.
Yes, that's correct. I was absolutely on a hunch and was rewarded by another trove of a similar number of letters between Friel and his short story editor, Roger Angel, who's actually quite well known as a writer himself in later decades in the United States.
Yes, because people may have forgotten that Friel was initially a short story writer and that he started with The Bell, the famous Irish publication, and then tried his luck with The New Yorker. And, it's not the closed doors that a lot of literary magazines might seem to be now. They've started corresponding and advising.
Oh, yes. And again, at a very rich, deep level, there was a relationship developed through those letters. The two men, Roger Angel, the editor, and Friel did not meet for the first 3 years of their friendship because, of course, Brian was in Derry, as he said, cut off, in the northernmost tip of Ireland. And he was very hungry for a kind of literary fellowship, sense of literary friendship and advice and guidance. And yes, received quite a lot of guidance. But it's true that The New Yorker saw something in him. They saw a spark.
Yes, because he would say, well, I know you've rejected this, but could you tell me more? Could you tell me more what I'm doing wrong?
Yes.
And then they would respond.
Yes, at length, often, and sometimes line by line, here's where the story goes wrong. And we don't want you to revise this story, although Friel often did try anyway to revise. But please send us more. Just try to be truer to yourself. That was really the advice that Angel gave him, was we're looking for truth in your fiction.
Now, bring us into the life he was living at that stage. He was living in Donegal at that stage?
No, he was still living in Derry. So he lived in, that's another thing. I don't think I quite realized how important the city of Derry was to his development. He was teaching for 10 years in Derry, got married at age 25 and had two young daughters soon afterward. So he was a married man, father of two young daughters. His wife, Anne, was an enormous influence on his work and a supporter and confidant and his first reader, traveled with him also to Minneapolis for 3 months to study theater when she herself was pregnant with their third child. And for each of his plays, as much as she could, she traveled with him, as did the children. So when his plays were performed here in Dublin, first by the Abbey Theatre, actually as early as 1962. His play, The Enemy Within, about St. Columba, was performed on stage at the Abbey. Anne and the children came down to Dublin and they rented a house so that the whole family could be here while he worked with the director to get the play up ready for performance.
And that time you're talking about those letters to the BBC and to the New Yorker, he had made this huge decision that he was, with Anne obviously on board, that he was going to give up his job as a teacher. So he was relying on money from these commissions.
Yes, he was. And that was quite a leap of faith. I mean, later on, I was able to interview Roger Angel, and his first quote, he wrote it to me in an email, was, Brian's agent and I were, quote, equally horrified when Brian announced he was giving up teaching and relying on writing for an income, because he hadn't quite developed the track record yet to gain a steady source of income from that, from the profession of writing. And yet he had confidence. That's something else that I think comes across. There's a great sense of humility in the letters, and that he's very eager for feedback. And yet he has a real sense of belief in himself and a very strong drive and a very, very firm confidence appropriately so. He had a very strong voice and just a remarkable, you know,
you
skill.
Spoke there about The Enemy Within, and of course, hot on the heels of that was Philadelphia, Here I Come, which was a wonderful success in Dublin. But of course, he always, with his eye to an international market, he wanted it to go to America and to London. And that wasn't as easy a path as we think of now.
You're right. And in fact, he took a lot of persuading. Brian himself wanted the play to go to London first, actually. But I think it's important to think of the early 1960s and the context. And British pop culture at that time was the Beatles, James Bond 007, the first Doctor Who movie had come out. And, you know, the producer who had invested in Philadelphia, Here I Come, said, look, an Irish play about a young man deciding whether to emigrate from Donegal. He said, I just don't know that this will be a hit. In London right now, I think you would have better luck in the United States, where John F. Kennedy had just been president. In every major American city, there were newly elected Irish American Catholic politicians, and Irish Americans themselves were coming into the rising middle class. And the theater going class is another point in Friel's favor. So those producers were correct, and the play Philadelphia, Here I Come became a huge hit in the United States first.
Now, there's another person who was key in his life, and that was Tyrone Guthrie, mm-hmm. and he had his theatre in Minneapolis. How did Friel know about him, and how was that connection formed?
Yes, well, The Enemy Within, which we were just talking about, was a huge hit in Dublin in the summer of 1962, in August, during the Dublin Horse Show. And Guthrie came to see it, loved it. I mean, Ronald Mason was actually there in the theater the same night as Guthrie and got talking with him and wrote Brian a letter.
And Guthrie was a theater director and producer with experience in England.
Yes, with much experience in England. He had spent decades at the Old Vic Theater and many other theaters. He'd founded the Shakespeare Festival in Canada. He had just been knighted, actually, in 1961. So he was very well recognized across the UK and worldwide. And he wrote Brian a 7-page fan letter about The Enemy Within and invited him to visit Anna McCarrig, which is now the Tyrone Guthrie Center. And that was just at the time that Guthrie was developing his new theater project in Minneapolis. So when Brian Friel was sat in the theater and watched the rehearsals, they were actually still in the course of building the theater. One of the actors rehearsing at that time said you could always hear hammers in the background, and they just barely got, you know, the construction finished in time for the theater's opening. And Brian Friel was there to witness all of that project.
And how important then did that feed into his work, that experience, the making of theater,
yes,
the making of a play?
Yes, on multiple levels. One was the physicality of the theater. And I think that's something that, you know, Friel hadn't actually had a lot of access to live theater growing up in Derry. But Guthrie was very much a fan of horseplay and physical jokes and gestures and also humor and comedy. And we see all of that in Philadelphia, Here I Come. The exuberance of Private Guard marching around the stage, kicking a soccer ball, saluting an imaginary general. I think a lot of that comes from Guthrie's influence. And then secondly, I would say that spirit of the provincial theater project must have fed into the founding of the Field Day Theater Company later in 1980, which was adamantly, you know, co-founded by Friel and Stephen Ray, and staged all of its plays first in Derry and then toured mainly market towns around Ireland, north and south. So Macrofelt, Dungannon, Ballyshannon, Tralee, you know, not the kind of glittery, sparkling theater venues that one might expect.
Of course, the wonderful theatre contrivance of Philadelphia, Here I Come is Gar Public and Gar Private, the splitting of the central character into two actors.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any insight into where that might have come from?
I can only speculate. I think, you know, especially drawing upon the radio plays, Friel was very interested in psychological drama, maybe psychodrama it might have been called at the time. And tried to always expose a character's inner mind, not always successfully. There was also another radio play around that time, strangely called The Disagreeable Oyster, written by Giles Cooper, who was an English dramatist who was very successful on the radio. And that play had a character split into two voices. The character's name was Bundy, and it was Bundy Major, Bundy Minor. It's possible, I I think strongly possible that Friel heard that on the radio or knew of it because he was studying radio drama, might have got the idea. He also credited Eugene O'Neill and the play Strange Interlude, which has a lot of asides spoken by the actors to try to reveal their inner thoughts. But it was really an innovation to have two physical characters, two physical actors portraying the same character, and a risk that he took and that succeeded brilliantly.
And of course, the thing that's stopping Gar Public and Gar Private is the father.
Yes.
Do we get any insight from letters about who the father in Philadelphia Here I Come might have been modelled on?
I would believe it's very much modelled on Friel's father or his perception of his father, because some of his early radio talks actually in BBC Northern Ireland were reminiscences of being his father's pupil. His father was a schoolmaster, and before the family moved to Derry, they moved there when Brian was 10 years old. Brian had attended a rural school and had been his own father's pupil. And his father was apparently a very strict disciplinarian and continued to tutor his son at home after hours. Brian said those sessions often ended in tears. And also the duality that he saw his father at home and also saw him in the classroom. So it's that focus on, the kind of unreachable, taciturn father.
Well, that sounds like a fit. My thanks to Kelly Matthews. Brian Friel, Beginnings, is published by Four Courts Press. You're in Dublin. Are you giving talks, Kelly?
Or? I will have a book launch tomorrow, actually, at 5:30 at Boston College, Ireland, on Stephen's Green. It'll be lovely to see people there. Emily Pine will be launching the book.
Well, that sounds very exciting. That's Kelly Matthews. As I said, Brian Friel, Beginnings is the name of the book. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Tommy O'Sullivan is on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show is produced by Reg Luby. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.